Hi everyone, we have a special announcement before we begin this week's episode. Have you ever wished that you could walk around a city and be given a private, intimate tour whispered into your ears in a sultry tone by a celebrity expert guide?
All the time. Yeah.
Well, that dream is now a reality if you're visiting London. Ooh. Because QI has teamed up with VoiceMap, a brilliant self-guided tour app to bring you the first quite interesting tours, packed full of our trademark unusual facts.
And narrated by none other than Mr. QI himself, Sir Stephen Fry.
Whoa. Yeah. You simply download the app from the Apple Store or Google Play, select your tour, stick your headphones in, and get walking.
It's really easy to use. You can put your phone away because VoiceMap monitors your location as you're on the move, and it plays audio to you automatically as you arrive at each location. So it's great. You don't need to check your phone the whole time.
You can do it whenever you like, and like start whenever, stop, have a drink, halfway through.
Do it at 3 a.m. if you're interested.
Creepy.
We've got good street lights here in London, so you know, you'll be able to see everything. We've put two London tours together so far, one of Westminster and one of the City and Bankside.
That's right. So whether you're a first-time visitor to London or a lifetime local, you can take directions from Stephen and see the city from a whole new perspective. For example, did you know that
London is home to over 8.4 million trees, covering 21% of the city? This means that by the UN's standards, it can officially be classified as a forest.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
I feel so healthy now.
Yeah. Or did you know that our most famous landmark, Big Ben,
keeps accurate time with the help of a handful of pre-decimal coins? A single penny balanced on the pendulum can speed the clock up by 2/5 of a second.
Who uses cash these days?
Yeah, only our clocks.
Well, yeah, only our clocks. That's where it all is.
You might discover how
London's classic red phone boxes were actually based on a tomb.
Oh, they do look quite like a tomb, actually.
So, what's not to love? To get started, just visit qi.com/voicemap.
If you're not going to be in London anytime soon, you can still get involved. You can listen to the tours virtually, just like a podcast or audiobook.
But before you crack into that, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Lunchbox Envy.
Hey!
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome aboard this episode of Lunchbox Envy. I'm your captain, Alex Bell, and I'm joined on the flight deck today by First Officers Manny Romeo and Jack Chambers. Topic ahead looks good, although we may be experiencing some spicier takes during Manny's section, so please do keep your headphones securely fastened at all times. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for choosing Lunchbox Envy, and we hope you have a pleasant listen. Cabin crew, FDG, thank you.
Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy, and we're doing travel foods today.
Yes, I know.
Food on the move.
Well, actually, the budget is stretched to a private jet, which you may be able to hear in the background.
Yeah, it's definitely not our horrible, janky air conditioning system because it's such a hot day today.
Oh my God.
I've got lots on plane food.
Yes, I've got lots on train food.
And I've got lots on boat food.
Perfect. Woo. Manny, why don't you kick us off and tell us that cavemen have been packed lunches.
Well, I was thinking about just traveling and food in general, and then realised that we were driven to travel by food.
That's
like,
so true.
As a species, this is why we went anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
So until we settled down, or kind of semi-settled down as a human species, and began our transition into farming, which is about 15,000 years ago. So there are like evidence of temporary cave dwellings in the Fertile Crescent. So that's when we kind of like stayed for a little bit, ate some stuff, and then realise, actually, no, we really do need to move on.
Oh, like Clacking Lane services.
Yes, exactly.
So little chef.
We moved for food. So hunter-gatherers moved for seasonal plants and grazing animals. They followed animals around.
Follow the herd.
Exactly. Mm. And even the animals that they domesticated quite early on, so say dogs and pigs, they took those animals with them. So in that sense, All food
is travel food.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so that's cool. But the pigs, it's quite binary. You can't eat some of the pig and have it carry on with you. Right? Well, it'd be great if we bred an animal that you could eat some
there
of.
There are. I mean, some communities do that with cattle, I think.
Yeah, they'll sip a little bit of their blood to keep them going.
Oh, that's cool. I was going to say, they didn't just take a rib.
No.
That would be like being on an edible motorbike.
Yes.
That you can eat chunks of.
I like how your mind thinks.
Yeah,
I remember reading, it was quite an interesting take for, I think it was Noah Yuval Harari, who wrote Sapiens, and he was like, in a way, wheat domesticated us, because wheat used to like grow in the fields and be a bit more wild and sporadic and would be killed by disease. And then it was like, tell you what, let's make ourselves really delicious and reliable for humans to grow, and then they'll stay here and grow more of us. And then we're more and more generations. I mean, obviously, it sort of works both ways.
The famous cats.
I was saying, I'm looking at my cat right now, who is lying on the floor living the life of luxury while I'm podcasting hard away to pay for the mortgage. So
and pay for his cat food.
Best and worst travelling foods, in your opinions? Big question.
I remember my family would deliberately get the slightly more expensive and slower Brittany ferries to France on holiday rather than the P&O ferries, because their food was better because it was French.
Oh.
So P&O ferries would do, like, you know, full English, beans on toast, because we're usually getting it at like 7 a.m. And then Brittany ferries would be like, pretty little glass of yogurt with your, you know, fresh croissant.
I made that decision because this is the problem I have with traveling, is we put up with any kind of journey often, like skimp so much money on an airline ticket because it's a bit cheaper.
Yeah.
I'll just put up with the 12 hours of hell it takes to get there. And I'm like, you're only there for 5 days. Yeah. So like 20% of the time, is that worth it?
Are we going to talk about airport beers?
Oh, we could.
Which is a weird concept that wherever you are, if you're about to start your holiday, whatever time of day, a beer is basically socially mandatory.
Is this an English thing?
I think it must be.
Okay.
I mean, even because the head of Ryanair, of all people, is trying to ban it. Because he's like, oh, why are all our customers completely drunk
leathered
at like 9 o'clock in the morning on our flights causing disruption?
I've never done it.
Yeah, I've known a lot of people to miss flights.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the airport beers. I accidentally lit up a cigarette in the middle of an airport because
you were drunk.
Wow. I completely forgot. My partner at the time was looking at me like, something's wrong here, I don't know what it is. And he was like, shit, Manu.
I'm strong with these pints.
I think my favourite meal in life is airport spoons breakfast.
Ooh.
So in the UK, there's a Wetherspoons in most major airports. Uh-huh. And it's not, I mean, the food is great. Like, I love a spoons breakfast, but it's more the context. So you're going on holiday.
Yeah.
So you're excited about that. You're usually going away with friends and people you like.
Yeah, yeah.
You're on a real like social high because everyone's turned up to the airport. Yeah. You've just got through the difficult, stressful bit. Like, everyone's made it through security.
True.
You've all got tickets. Everyone relaxes. You're all stuck there. No one's like going anywhere. No one's going to leave. No one's late.
No,
like,
one's
you're
Irish joining exit.
Up. Everyone has those fun. Someone's bought a newspaper. Good purgatory. You're just like, we're stuck here and it's great. So, like, purgatory. Let's go and have a great week. And then there's a contrast of coming back where everyone's exhausted, flight's delayed. You're stuck in a KFC in a Spanish airport.
I was looking at the best and worst travelling foods, kind of like legally speaking.
Oh, yeah.
Surströmming, which we've eaten.
Yeah, we've tried that.
Oh, yeah.
Not allowed on planes.
Listen
not
to
just
the...
because it smells horrendous, but because it's a pressurised
tank. It is pressurised. Remember it? Like, it hissed when we opened it.
Explode.
Like a Horcrux.
Exactly. It was terrifying. Durian.
Oh, yeah.
Classically not allowed.
A really smelly fruit.
It's smelly.
Southeast
very,
Asia.
Very smelly. So it's a tropical Southeast Asian fruit, which is custody, and I've tried it. It's kind of delicious, but
sorry, it's in custody.
It will land you in custody because it's illegal.
So it's quite sweet, quite desserty, but it smells like rotting garbage.
Yeah, there's one in our freezer in the office.
What, still?
Yeah.
Why?
Wow.
It was a pilot for another podcast that we tried at QI.
Oh, the one where you were doing like disgusting foods.
Yes, yeah, that was a challenge. Find the most disgusting thing in London and bring it to me.
Mm.
It's 3 years later, still in the
Why?
Freezer.
I'm so glad I'm producing this podcast and not that one. All right, let's crack into our first lunchbox. And this week, that is mine.
Great.
And I've brought a selection of in-flight meals for you.
Oh, great. Would you like the chicken or the beef?
Chicken or the beef, yeah. First dish is... fried chicken and scrambled eggs.
Oh, look at that. It's delicious.
Second dish is this, hope you think, beautifully presented smorgasbord featuring beef and asparagus and pickles.
Mm-hmm.
And then for dessert, Zweibeck, which is a kind of dessert toast with peaches and Cream.
Whipped cream. Squirty cream, wow. My favourite. I mean, I've never been on a flight that served this selection.
Mm-mm. No, none of us have, because these are all meals from the golden age of airline cuisine. Mm. So I want to take you through the history of food in the air,
sure, mm-hmm. yeah.
and use it to prove why airlines definitively hate us.
Okay.
So let's start right at the beginning with the first ever plane meal. Do you want to guess when that was?
The same year the Wright brothers flew.
I love the idea that the Wright brothers did a quick in-service meal, like in like the 17-second yeah. flight. They were just like quickly down with the trolley. Come yes. on, come on. The first in-flight meal was 1919.
Oh,
I was served on a face. Flight from London to Paris, so we could have caught it. A company called Handley Page Transport, and they had a modified World War One bomber.
Oh,
wow. It was a repurpose for passenger use.
So they put the food in the bomb compartment.
Yeah. It was cost £3. It was a lunchbox, a literal lunchbox, oh. with just a sandwich and some fruit. There might have been some chocolate. And apparently it was dished out by, quote unquote, cabin boys.
Oh, I like
that
it.
Sounds unnecessarily
so hot. Yeah. Yeah. But actually, I think it was quite unusual in the early days to have dedicated flight attendants, because it used to be that the co-pilots would just come out of the cockpit really? And like hand out picnic baskets, which I think is a bit worrying.
Yeah. As long as it's not both of them at the same
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Wait, and I thought you were watching the plane.
Yeah. Yeah. Why is the coffee pouring sideways?
I was going to say, I read in early planes, they also, because they didn't have the pressurized cabins, so everyone had to wear those masks as
well, right from the start. Yeah, the mask also makes it harder to eat as
yeah,
well.
Yeah,
well,
you could slurp up a milkshake, couldn't you, through the tube?
They could just put oxygen and coffee yeah. through the same tube.
The Huel Airlines.
Yeah. So that was the first meal, first hot meal. It was in 1928, 29th of April, from Berlin to Paris.
Mm. It took 9 years to get the heating technology.
Mm-hmm. Lufthansa, but it says it was an insulated bottle system. So I think they mostly heated it on the ground and then sort of stuffed it into thermos tubes or some kind of insulated thing. But it says one of the first hot meals available was scrambled eggs and fried chicken, which you could do worse. You
know? I was going to say, this
That's a nice combo.
Amazing.
Very American.
Yeah,
lovely.
Very American. Then in 1936 was the first kind of kitchen on a plane was United Airlines became the first airline to do this. Mm. And this is because in 1933, they had bought a brand new fleet of planes for a huge amount of money in those days, $3.5 million. They spent all this on 60 new Boeing 247s, nice and shiny and new. They went into service in 1933. And then a few months later, Douglas DC-3 came out, which was a bit bigger and a bit faster. And all their competitors bought that instead.
Oh, no.
So they were like, shit, we just spent all this money on these brand new planes. Uh-huh. We can't scrap them, but they're not quite as good as all our competitors.
Yeah, it's a bit like investing in Betamax and then VHS comes out.
Exactly. Yeah. So they had to find an edge and they decided to lean into the service on board. So they hired a guy called Donald F. McGarrell, who was the world's first airline cuisine executive consultant. And he said, well, build a kitchen at, I think it was Oakland Airport. Mm-hmm. And he hired chefs from Switzerland and Austria and France. And like they created proper menus and tried to kind of do proper gourmet food. And this is when they also started thinking about how to optimize food for eating in the sky, you know, with pressure and everything, which I guess we'll talk about later.
Yeah, of course, the science behind it.
Yeah.
I still think it's crazy that you're sort of expected to deliver meals for the people on board your plane if it's more than like 2 hours, right?
Let's talk about this. We're now at the end of the golden age of food, but there's a really interesting story behind it.
Great.
So I'm glad you asked.
Set you up nicely.
So the 1950s, I would say, was when you had amazing meals. And this was actually all down mainly to regulation. Mm-hmm. So from the 1930s, the aviation industry in a lot of countries around the world was quite heavily regulated, partly because when steam had come around before, there'd been a lot of instability, a lot of boom and bust. And like price wars because it was such a big opportunity for a new industry. So there was an organization called the International Air Transport Association.
Oh, IATA.
They still do the codes,
don't they?
The what?
Oh, yeah.
Like London Heathrow is LHR. That's an IATA code.
They run everything around the world, basically. So this organization, they fixed the routes that airlines could offer and the fares. And there was so little to differentiate between the companies. And so actually the in-flight service became the primary battleground for getting the edge for decades. So the quality of the food basically shot up.
Mm.
A few examples of this. TWA coach passenger service mm-hmm. in the early 1970s could expect a starter of Dungeness crab, harvest salad with blue cheese, a choice of charbroiled filet mignon Ooh. With Bordelaise sauce, veal scallopini with fettuccine alfredo, or wow. roast pork loin in a cherry sauce.
I don't even know what half those foods are. But you still, it was expensive as shit though.
When my
family came over from Mauritius, a lot of families did this. Like, you had to save up a crazy amount of money. But also you dressed up because you knew it was fancy.
Dressing to fly.
Honestly, it was like Sunday style outfits. Everyone looked amazing.
Do you not still?
Yes.
But you're absolutely right. It was luxury. And then when economy class arrived in about 1958, the IATA felt that it was a real threat to the established order because the ideal business is only the richest people in the world paying loads of money for your stuff. So like they were trying to contain it. Mm. They had this conference in Paris in 1957 in which they standardized the rules for a bare bones economy service.
Cool.
They weren't allowed to serve alcohol, only tea, coffee, mineral water.
And Ryanair was born.
Yeah, sandwiches as well. And actually sandwiches were a bit of a sticking point.
Oh yeah.
So this is what I want to talk about next, which was the sandwich wars. They said basically you have to serve a sandwich, but really no more than a sandwich.
Okay.
But no one really defined what a sandwich was.
This old chestnut.
Exactly. So Americans were all just serving like cellophane wrapped package sandwiches, pretty standard. Uh-huh. The European airlines like KLM and Air France started exploiting this loophole and they started constructing quite elaborate meals on a slice of bread. So what we have in front of us today is my quite poor imitation of the Scandinavian Airlines smorgasbord, which they would serve free to passengers. They have 5 slices of ox tongue, a lettuce hot, asparagus and sliced carrots on a single slice of bread.
That counts as a sandwich.
Swiss Air provided passengers with an assortment of 12 dainty appetizer sandwiches, followed by primary sandwich, followed by 2 dessert sandwiches. So you can see how they're kind of taking the piss.
I love it.
This obviously upset the American Airlines. Mm-hmm. They were like, well, we're supposed to be doing sandwiches. Yeah. So they complained to the IATA.
Mom, they're not making sandwiches in Europe. And I want those.
And then there was a series of like public escalation. Like the Scandinavian Airlines put out these adverts saying, on our planes, you won't find rubbery indigestibles wrapped in cellophane. And then they like, where Swiss Air said that every man is entitled to his concept of a sandwich and we have ours. So it got a little bit spicy.
Fittingly, some beef.
There was beef. There was beef between the airlines. Yeah. They had to have a special meeting in London, the IATA.
Was
it gated?
Define the sandwich in the most miserable terms they could.
Oh, no.
Which was as a cold, simple, unadorned, and inexpensive item consisting of a substantial and visible chunk of bread. Containing nothing normally regarded as expensive or luxurious, such as smoked salmon, oysters, caviar, lobster, game, asparagus, pâté de foie gras, and no overgenerous or lavish helpings which affect the monetary value of the unit.
That's amazing. Wow. So, I imagine coming up with a list of like things deemed expensive.
Mm-hmm. Well, too nice. Like definitively airlines are not on your side. Okay, like they had a special meeting and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars probably flying around the world to be like, how do we make our sandwiches shit enough for economy?
And now I suppose all the a lot of them are going the other way and trying to cut costs and make sure you pay for your own sandwiches.
Well, that's
stuff,
because
right?
The industry was massively deregulated in about 1978. Yeah. They were free to compete on like price and routes and everything like that. And actually the food was the first thing to go.
Yeah, no, I was reading about this post-deregulation period for airlines. And there's a famous story of in the 1980s, the CEO of American Airlines, Robert Crandall, heard that people didn't really like the olives in the first class salad very much.
Oh.
And he was like, let's take those away. And by removing like basically a single olive from each salad, he saved the company about $40,000 a year, which today is about £130,000.
Wild. My God, when you think about the margins you're working with, that's crazy.
But I always hear this story and I'm like, that just proves how many flights.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like they're working with such huge figures.
Yeah, so that has probably actually saved them like a third of a million.
At the end of the day, we got a good QI fact out of it, and that's all that matters because it sounds interesting.
We've been doing all that for years.
I love the idea of checking what people are leaving behind because this is still something that airlines do. They'll count basically all of the leftovers after a flight. They'll see which are the favourite meals and then just like get rid of them.
That's
the
really clever. Data analysis. Another example more recently in the 2010s, Northwest Airline saved $500,000 a year by slicing the limes they put in the drinks into 16ths rather than tenths.
That's great, right? Yeah, again, that's a much better version of that. Or it's like an extension.
No, you never notice that.
Who is doing that slicing, though? Because I can barely slice a lime.
Probably a robot, actually.
The robot cost $500,000, though.
What's the deal with plane food?
I was waiting for somebody to ask this.
So it's a trope associated with Jerry Seinfeld, the 1990s. I mean, he's still alive, but he was a stand-up comedian who was in America. But yeah, apparently he never actually said those specific lines.
Oh.
He would talk about airline food in his set.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did an SNL skit a bit later where he was sort of self-mockingly...
Yeah.
And it was, but yeah, he never actually said it. And I had heard this trope all the time. And anyway, I don't know what the punchline
was.
I've
got the answer.
Because
I think I wrote this Ricky I book ages ago. But
nice.
Obviously, I went and found out what actually is the deal with airplane food. Why does it taste different and weird?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the answer is kind of obvious, to be honest. It's mostly about the air in the cabin. The first thing is that cabins are not very humid.
Okay.
The humidity drops to about 12%, which is drier than most deserts.
No.
I think they're a bit better these days, but like definitely when I started flying when I was younger, like cabin air was pretty, like it got pretty bad. So it's low humidity and also low pressure, of course. And that leads to less saliva flowing around inside you, dries out your nasal passages. And that means that you have a lower sensitivity to sweet and salty flavors, about 30% less. Mm.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. And the bulk of how we perceive taste is via smell, it's by these kind of things. You could kind of compare it to having a bad cold.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other interesting variable is the noise. So the noise in the cabin, can reach 85 decibels. And there was a research done by food scientists at Cornell University in 2015. Mm-hmm. Two scientists called Kimberly Yan and Robin Dando, a cross-modal role for audition in taste perception.
Oh.
Great read.
I'm going to listen to the audiobook.
Yeah. And they found that the noisier the environment, the more your sweet and salty perception is dulled.
Mm.
Wow.
Really weird. Yeah.
I saw that gastrophysics there.
It's exactly. Well, Charles Spence wrote a lot about airplane food. One of the things he points out is how that noise level does something really weird to your umami taste receptors.
Yeah.
It boosts them, which is why apparently people enjoy foods like tomato juice or like any kind of really savory thing. Super interesting.
Yeah.
Lufthansa actually did a survey on some of their passengers and said they drank tomato juice in plane journeys, but they never drink it on the ground.
Wow.
Speaking of preferences, there was a period of time when there wasn't very much plane food available, if you can imagine when that might have been.
COVID
during the pandemic. Yeah. All the flights were grounded. Obviously, you'd imagine it's probably a bad time to be in the airline food business.
Mm.
But Thai Airways in April 2020, they were nearly going bankrupt.
Yeah.
But they started selling their in-flight meal boxes for delivery.
That's genius.
And by September, they'd converted the cafeteria at its headquarters into like an airline-themed restaurant.
Cool.
And decorated it with like airline seats, and like, cabin crew were there to like the wait for
you. The 85 decibel hum.
Yeah. Okay, from planes to trains, let's crack into our second lunchbox, and that is Jack's.
Yes, I'm very excited to deliver to you the...
Is it going to be a replacement bus lunchbox?
I have brought you a ham sandwich wrapped in cling film.
Oh!
Rather squished and stale, the British Rail sandwich. To represent the very British concept of disappointment.
That's giving Ron Weasley on the Hogwarts Express.
I think this should be in a museum because this kind of sums up.
It looks like it's been in a museum.
For hundreds of years. Because I think this represents a key part of what it means to be British. So this is basically a sort of British in-joke from most of the 20th century.
Mm.
So when railways first started being built in the UK... They were all private companies and they were all competing with each other. In 1948, they decided to nationalise the railways, to have them all under one umbrella, make it much easier to manage. And so they created British Rail. And they had to provide catering. So one thing they provided was sandwiches. Incredibly disappointing and stale and boring sandwiches.
And we're talking like... Triangles of processed bread.
Wrapped in cling film.
Mm.
There was much mockery. The Goon Show. Which was a famous radio comedy show in the 1950s. It had an episode called The Collapse of the British Rail Sandwich System. Spike Milligan himself had a gag, missing Van Gogh ear found in British Rail Sandwich. Douglas Adams posited that British Rail washed and repackaged their sandwiches in cling film for reuse the next day. Bill Bryson wrote, I can remember when you couldn't buy a British Rail sandwich without wondering if this is your last act before a long period on a life support machine. Like, people go in hard.
We love to hate the sandwiches.
Exactly.
It's very British, like having a go at a British service.
Yeah. And in fact, Charles Dickens, even before the railways were nationalised, he wrote a series of railway stories in 1866 in serial form. One of the stories features a woman who's just come back from the continent and was horrified to hear that the French actually had delicious food and like crispy baguettes and charcuterie. Mm. And she preferred the good old-fashioned British disappointing sandwiches.
I read some account of a politician somewhere when they went to some kind of European EU summit or G7 summit, and there was a train put on where sort of every country had a carriage.
Cool.
And yeah, apparently the French had a sort of amazing like kind of meal set on, and the Germans had a sort of incredible stuff, and then the British just had cheer sandwiches and like really flying the flag.
But I think it's our national sport. Yeah. Although this is also, we talked about in the sandwich episode, this is before M&S revolutionised, and I do think I think I said on the day we have the best sandwiches in the world now.
We do, yeah.
So we've come on a long way, and you know, this is kind of a,
the trains aren't so good, but
no, true. So then in the 70s they started competing with short haul flights, so they were sort of ramping up, especially the first class menu. Intercity 125, my favourite British rolling stock.
Don't get him started.
Had a dining car as well as a buffet service. So you get the trolley that goes down, and some places have the buffet car where there's basically just a person behind a counter and they'll give you a sandwich or a coffee. That's the most they can cook. But a dining car is separate where you have actual tables, usually with starched white linen tablecloths and
I'm
waiters
coming around.
I'm
imagining like the Orient Express.
Exactly. So the Intercity 125 had a dining car, and apparently the first class menu included kippers for breakfast, asparagus soup and gammon steak with glazed peach and golden fried chip potatoes. Children under 13 paid half price, and as the menu said, diners are requested to refrain from smoking immediately prior to and during the course of the meal. Which just tells you what a time it was.
Yeah,
people were
amazing.
Actually smoking. And Prue Leith, actually, of Great British Bake Off fame, designed some of the menus in the 1970s. And then comes the Thatcherism of the 80s and the sort of championing of the free market. Mm. And so inevitably the railways get privatised a bit later, 1994. And basically now sandwiches get a bit of a flashy makeover. It also coincides with, as we mentioned in the sandwich episode, M&S and the other supermarkets following suit. So the sort of death of the British Rail disappointing sandwich comes in the 1990s, but it does still linger and is often used as a sort of a euphemism. Like I remember an article from 2009 where people were talking about how Heathrow was becoming the British Rail sandwich of the airports. It was like, it's still kind of used to be something that's kind of, all right, if we have to, you know, like we've got to provide some sort of catering.
What's it, like malicious compliance?
Yeah, a little bit.
That's such a good term.
Anyway.
It's really how we operate this podcast.
Around 2001, someone found a 30-year-old document. So this is from 1971, instructing staff how to best make a sandwich on British Rail trains.
I think I've seen this.
Have you seen
because
this?
Because I went and got a behind-the-scenes tour of the National Railway Museum a few years ago in York. Yeah.
So basically they were telling you to put more filling near the middle, where the slice happens, mostly
where
margarine.
Where the slice happens, so that you can, so when it's sliced, the side that's presented to you looks really thin.
So this is the biggest controversy,
like,
and this is what I've done here, is you get your two slices of ham.
Hang on, I'm going to open this horrible sandwich.
You're welcome to eat them.
Oh, I'm okay, but thank you.
So particularly when making ham sandwiches.
What have you done?
You have your square of sandwich, which picture a top-down view, bird's eye view of your slice of bread. It's been buttered, and then you put a slice of ham over it.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do you put your second slice of ham? What you do is you fold it in half, or thirds even, and then you put it across the diagonal, right?
So when you
and
look at the sandwich from the side, it looks like there's four slices of ham.
Looks like there's...
But that's just one little bit of it.
It's so sneaky.
So sneaky. That's a bit like when you buy a pizza from the supermarket and it's got a little window and you're like, it's covered in pepperoni, and it's just a bit in the window.
It's just a bit in the window. Anyway, so that was the biggest controversy when they found this document.
I'm going to rewrap this for recent...
Give it a wash.
Yeah, I'm going to give it through the dishwasher. Another train passenger. I do agree. I think this should be maybe under a bell jar in an exhibit somewhere.
Even more withered.
To represent British culture.
It'll get even more British as it withers.
Yeah.
Of course, now the current government are slowly renationalising the railways. So I wonder if we'll see a return of the great
Makes
British
sandwiches disorder. Shit again.
Yeah, exactly.
What if you were doing a Prue Leith and designing the menus for these new sandwiches? What would they be?
What sandwiches would they be? Starmer ham, I call it. in honour of our departed Prime Minister. They should name them after Prime Ministers who've all resigned.
Liz Truss is just lettuce. So that is the summary of British sandwiches and British train catering from the 20th century. Pretty tragic. But if we go around the world, in Greece, they have an equivalent phrase, which is crayfish coffee. because they have so many ferries, Greece, because there's so many islands. Often the service is a bit rubbish, and if you get a coffee, it's the worst coffee you can get in Greece.
Bad coffee on the ferries.
So it basically means bad coffee, and for some reason they've gone for crayfish. Maybe the implication is like you've sort of mixed it with a crayfish because it's all salty and horrible.
Maybe it's a pun in Greek or something. Yeah. Well, it's good to know we can connect with Greeks over that then, if I ever get gobbled.
Any Greek listeners, please.
Yeah, right in. Yeah. Currently, if you go to Japan, you can find what is the highly collectible Ekiben.
Oh,
I've heard of
these. You've been to Japan?
What's an Ekiben?
No, you've just heard of them. So it comes from
It's a portmanteau, isn't it?
Yeah, Eki means railway station and Ben comes from bento. So if you're familiar with Japanese food, you get the bento lunchboxes, which are basically compartmentalized.
Yeah, yeah.
And they started in the late 19th century as train travel spread around Japan. Mm-hmm. And until the 1960s, peddlers would actually sort of walk the platforms. So your train would stop at the platform, you'd open a window and someone would be like trying to sell you some food.
Kind of like a drive-through though.
Yeah.
The train is driving through.
But what's interesting is how they've basically marketed it, because they're hyper-localized to the specialities of the area you're going through. So it's a bit like if you went through...
Oh, so it's like a cultural taste.
Yeah, if you went through like Leeds and they served you Yorkshire puddings, and then you got to Scotland and they started serving you haggis.
But I love that. That's such a great way.
And they're
it's
so...
like exactly the same as that train with all of the different countries.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Except like you're just within... The, so it's, I think it's to promote intra-Japanese tourism, because you go through the beef area and you can get an Ekiben, which is in the shape of a cow's head. And then you open it up, and there's this beautifully arranged, like, sushi and, like, rice. And actually, the cow one self-heats when you pull a string.
What?
It self-heats.
God, Japan's just, like, light years ahead of us.
They're living in the year 3000. And they're rabbit-shaped ones, train-shaped ones, so it looks like the train you're actually sitting in.
Sick.
They're, like, nice lunchboxes, I guess. Just nice. Like, biscuit tins.
And if you buy one in Japan en route, they're between £5 and £7, which actually sounds like
I can't wait. I'm hoping to go to Japan next year.
Can you please bring back some Ekiben boxes?
This will be Ekiben EV from that point on. We do have, in the UK, that's something I am quite proud of from British trains, is the drinking culture.
Yes, train fines.
I mean, it is banned on like the London Underground
TfL,
and some local
Transport for London
networks.
Don't let you do it.
But like around the train network in the UK, you can, and they sell alcohol. And it's, I think part of the reason is because we have a very old train network, and the trains largely terminate in the centre of where they're going to,
that's
in the city centre. So people aren't getting in cars and driving on.
Yes.
They walk to and from.
Oh, I see.
On TfL banning drinking, the day before the ban came in,
there was a massive
party.
Yeah,
everyone was invited to
go
and drink,
that.
And it was on the Circle Line, so it never ended.
Wow.
So the train just went round and round and round, and people just got steadily more and more drunk, and then
That's
obviously
great.
Got off when they wanted.
Okay, time to take to the high seas.
Oh,
our third lunchbox, which is from Manu.
Today, I have brought a piece of bamboo and a bowl of water, some dirt, and the urine of a young boy. This is the third time I have brought urine onto this.
It's insane.
We set the bar so low.
Yeah,
you miss it every time.
So these are three old Chinese cures for seasickness.
Okay.
Because today I wanted to talk about the perils of cooking and eating at sea. So we've been traveling at sea for at least 10,000 years, really, really long time. The world's oldest boat is called the Pessay Canoe, which was found in a bog in the Netherlands. It's wooden, but because of the bog, it was really, really well preserved. But there are some historians that think we might have been traveling for at least 50,000 years, and some think we've been traveling even before we were human. So, like, 30 to 50,000 years of
sea travel.
The word
we is doing a lot of heavy work there.
I mean, like, human-y looking things.
So if you get off a Ryanair flight, you don't feel human by the end of it.
So basically, the reason we get seasick is because there's a system in our inner ear which measures our movement and compares it to our surroundings. And if there's a mismatch between what we can see and what we can feel, it tends to make us feel quite sick.
It's kind of travel sickness generally, right? Is it the same principle
exactly
for being on a coach?
Sickness. And lots of different things can cause it. It's not just travel. So if you're looking into a microscope for too long, you can get travel sick.
No way.
If you're...
this is scientists just throwing up on their bedroom.
Like, legit. It's a thing. If you're returning from a long time at sea, you can get travel sickness being on land.
Your
body's, it's called mal de barquement syndrome.
You get your sea legs,
exactly,
but the other way
so
around.
You get land
legs. I think that's a bit performative. I've been away for so long. I can't even remember what it's like to stand on land. Like when astronauts come back from Earth and they're like, oh, I'm collapsing. Gravity.
Like hold spoons and drop them.
It's,
and
it's
find
such nonsense.
So
I just don't believe it.
I don't believe it.
They see, they do it on videos all the time.
And it's debunked. I'm sure it's, I think it's staged.
I think they're just there. Just fine.
We know a lot about how it works.
Okay.
How to cure it, a bit trickier. So there have been lots of mad historical cures, but this trio from an old Chinese medical text that was written in the 17th or 18th century is for sure my favourite. So it recommends drinking the urine of young boys. This has a wondrous effect.
Comes up way too often in history. They're obsessed with young boy urine.
Or you can collect water drops that have come from a long bamboo stick into a bowl, and then you boil that water and you drink it. That's also very effective, apparently. Mm. And then the final one, which is to take some earth or dirt from the middle of your kitchen and then hide it under your hair.
Okay.
And you can't tell anyone about it because otherwise it won't work. But apparently that's supposed to help with the seasickness as well. The reason I'm talking about it is obviously it's a hazard for anyone who's traveling at sea or in a car looking at your phone. But it's a particular, it's a really specific occupational hazard for boat chefs, people that cook on boats.
Because they won't have windows, I guess.
No, I know. And you've got all of this movement. So getting used to that motion and the seasickness is a really big part of being able to do your job. But I love that the waves can get so intense that the kitchen has to adapt as well. All of the walls are padded so that if you fall backwards, you don't smack your head on the ceiling. I mean, you do, but you won't die. And the best thing is the whole cooker is on a gimbal. So the boat's going crazy.
That's so cool. This
pot of soup is completely level.
Is there footage?
Yes, really, really cool kitchens and equipment that's all adapted to cooking at sea.
That's so cool.
I'd say the one thing that you cannot prepare for is rich people.
Uh-oh.
I have watched so many videos of private yacht chefs for this research.
It's called Below Deck. It's one of the best TV series in the world.
It's incredible. So I actually tried to speak to a yacht chef for this episode. I'm friends of a friend of one, and she was too busy to talk to me.
Really?
She's like, I'm so sorry. I'm cooking this back-to-back like 3 days.
Live in the sloshing kitchen.
No time. There is a yacht chef called Nina Wilson, who's Australian. She's a private yacht chef, and she posts loads of really good YouTube videos, and she explains what it's like to cook on a boat for this kind of client. So she works on chartered yachts, and she's saying it's amazing because there's no budget. People will just give you all of their money to cook whatever you want, and you have incredible creative freedom.
Oh, so there's unlimited budget. Sorry. Yeah. Okay,
no budget.
Zero. There's like unlimited. You can basically.
It's a big difference.
Difference. Whatever you want. You need to have incredible organizational skills because obviously you're away for like days or weeks at a time.
Yeah, that's true. Everything in advance.
Everything needs to be prepped in advance. You also need to be prepared to wake up at like the middle of the night and make whatever they want.
Yeah.
So she's telling stories of people who'd wake her up at like 2 in the morning and ask for like livers and grits and all of this really specific food, and she had to make it.
Wow.
And it's not just the food. So apparently the service, like requests to the waiters and waitresses, can get really weirdly specific.
Okay.
And the vibe is you cannot say no unless it's like illegal or harmful or sexual. So there was a story told by someone who worked on these private yachts. One of the guests asked that she watched him eat for the entire duration of the trip. So every time he ate anything, she would have to be there.
I'd say that's sexual.
But she did it.
Wow.
And that's the kind of service you get on a chartered yacht.
Maybe we're allowed to do this on planes and we just haven't tried it yet. I'm going to try next time.
One clever loophole.
I want the pilot to watch me. Okay, that's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox MV.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox MV Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions or suggestions for future topics by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
And we will see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Lunchbox MV was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Onrio, and produced by me, Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.